Coming up on this week's show, why your granddad might want to come out of retirement.
Rumours of the next big Resident Evil remake.
And the story of the British Home Computer Wars with Tony Sain.
This week's show is brought to you by Retro Gamer, the essential guide to classic games.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 220, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And can I just say how much I miss you guys? I can't believe I haven't seen you for like 2 weeks now, because again, we are recording this week's show, of course, remotely. I think it went all right last week, though, judging by the reaction.
Yeah, some people seem to really like it. And, you know, they said Joe was a slightly bit echoey.
Yeah, I've tried to sort that, so I've moved from the kitchen to the spare room, which does mean I'm sat on the floor right now behind the couch, but hopefully that will help.
The things you do for this podcast, Joe.
Absolutely, my back's in bits.
We did have people commenting going, yeah, all sounding good, guys, but, you know, how big is Joe's kitchen? It sounds cavernous. You've actually moved into the west wing of your house.
Yeah, exactly. Can I just say, it is a big kitchen, but it's because it's a kitchen diner.
It's because you're a rocker. They think you're like Ozzy Osbourne in this kind of huge...
He's actually on a Lilo in his swimming pool at the moment.
Yeah, actually.
So this week, again, doing the show remotely, but we've got some really good stories to talk about. I think we're getting the hang of this now. And we are going to bring you an incredible guest on the show, just like we do every week on the Retro Hour podcast. Now, Ravi, you probably watched this when it was on. Probably, it's actually over 10 years ago now. Micro Men.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. It was a really good, like, dramatization of the... Home Computer Wars in the UK, and it really unique because, you know, like Clive Sinclair was a really interesting character and he had his C5 and stuff, and, you know, it really takes you back to that time, and it was actually pretty well acted for, you know, one of these dramatizations. I've seen other ones that have not been as good as Micro Men. I think it's at the top of these kind of category.
And it's become a bit of a cult classic in the 11 years since it was on TV over here in the UK, probably because there's a dodgy upload of it on YouTube. I think it's had quite a lot of views. But today, we're going to be joined by the writer of Micro Men, Tony Sain. Now, he's actually an award-winning screenwriter for television, a really long career behind him. He's not much of a technologist, but he found this story really interesting. And obviously, to write Micro Men, he had to research the topic really in depth. So today we're going to get the story behind how Micro Men, if you've seen it before, this is going to be really interesting, a bit of a behind-the-scenes look about how that docudrama came together, but also a bit more of a general chat about the early 80s home computer wars here in Britain, which really was centred around Sinclair versus Acorn. And it is, you know, the fact that it was made into a movie for television should tell you everything you need to know, that it's actually a story that's full of drama, full of twists and turns and unexpected events. So this is a really interesting one, the story of Micro Men and the British home computer wars with Tony Sain. He's going to be our guest on the show in around 15 minutes from now. Now, before we get into the news stories this week, let's just give a huge shout to the team at the Retro Computer Museum in Leicester, which, you know, we've been there lots of times over the years. It's a fabulous place, but unfortunately, like a lot of people at the moment, it's been quite badly affected by the current crisis, and they need a bit of help right now.
Well, they're kind of funded by people turning up, paying and, you know, playing on these machines and having the place active. And of course, it's just sitting empty at the moment, so they need some funds to kind of keep them going. And it's a really fantastic place. It's really focused on kind of the community and just like a lovely little club when you turn up and they've got all these amazing machines, including some of the old VR machines, which are fantastic. So they're trying to raise £30,000 to kind of help them keep going. And, you know, we really don't want to see this place shut down because me and Dan absolutely love this place. We need to take Joe someday.
Yeah, definitely.
It is an incredible place, and I think you summed it up perfectly there. The fact that when you go, it kind of feels a bit like a cozy, like, users group, doesn't it? Like, you know, all familiar faces there, and, you know, they've got the most incredible layout. And they've got, I mean, if you've not been there before, you've kind of got the main area where there's just machines set up all around the room. You go in the back, there's an arcade section. You've got the old virtuality VR machines from the early 90s. And then there's another section that's just dedicated to software. And pretty much any bit of software that you can ever imagine. They've probably got about four or five copies of it on the shelves in there. They've done such a good job of not only preserving it all, but displaying it all as well. And like you said, it would be an absolute tragedy if that place wasn't around anymore. So they have got a Just Giving page at the moment. Obviously, we appreciate the time's so hard for everybody right now, but it is definitely a worthwhile cause. So I'll link that up in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, of course, we're all at home at the moment. I don't know about you guys, but I do see lots of people on social media saying, oh, I'm climbing the walls now. I've played all my games. I've watched everything on Netflix. If you need something to entertain you and stimulate your mind a little bit, have a look at this. Now, this week's show is brought to you by our friends at the incredible Retro Gamer magazine. Now, I think I speak for you guys as well. I've been a reader of Retro Gamer for as long as I can remember now.
Oh, it's an awesome magazine. You know, I've got so many on my shelf, and this edition is fantastic. They've got regular columnists in there that are really funny. And Ian Lee, a lot of people may know him from, like, Fun Bandits. He does a column at the moment, and in it, he's talking about how he's never actually completed a video game. You know, he's always tried to complete them, but never put the... Well, he's put the effort in, but he's never got to that stage.
Which, I was reading that column as well the other day, and I was trying to think back to how many games I've actually completed. And if I'm honest, I could probably count them on one hand.
That's disappointing.
I know Joe's probably completed more games in a weekend than I've done in my entire life, to be fair.
Maybe. I'm a bit of a completionist sometimes, so I at least like to kind of finish the main story in games. So, you know, but it is funny to read when people, you know, they play so many games and stuff that sometimes they just don't get the chance to finish them.
Well, this week's issue is also kind of talking about the Mega Drive versus SNES and the great 16-bit war, which was Sega versus Nintendo. And they're talking here about the strategies that they had. So Club Nintendo was actually a really big thing where they were trying to get kids engaged and, you know, have it like a fan club and a community. But also, whilst that was going on, they had Sega with their pirate TV advertising that was going on MTV, which is trying to get a little bit of the kind of older crowd. So they have a bit of a comparison. And then they have a History of Iridium, which is absolutely fantastic title. And a great little article about how, you know, Kraft Gold, they created it on the C64. And they believed that it couldn't be converted to the ZX Spectrum until Dominic Robinson created a demo, and that completely changed their mind. So looking at all stages of Iridium, and it's just fantastic.
Now, Retro Gamer is, of course, the only high street magazine dedicated to all aspects of retro gaming. And that's what you get every month, exclusive access to developers, giving you behind-the-scenes stories and telling you about those systems that you grew up playing and those video games as well, revisiting those game libraries with expert insight, and you uncover fascinating new facts about those games from your childhood. Now, I'm sure that everyone who's listening to this has at least read an issue of Retro Gamer before, but listen, now's a perfect time to check it out. Future Publishing spring sale is on now, so that means you can get up to 83% off the price and get the copies delivered straight to your door. So that means we've got an exclusive offer for you right now. You can get 5 issues of Retro Gamer magazine for just £5. Normally, that will cost you 25 quid in the shop. So that is a huge saving. And the loads of other magazines you can choose from as well, including official PlayStation, Edge, or PC Gamer, all 5 for £5. So if you want to claim this right now, and of course, you'll be really helping out our podcast by doing this, all you have to do is head to this website, open a new tab in your browser right now, and go to myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/spring209. So that's myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/spring209. And I'll, of course, put that in our show notes as well. Thanks to Retro Gamer, the essential guide to classic games. Now, of course, at the moment, we're all kind of getting used to the new way of living, the new normal. But there are things that keep cropping up in the news that are, shall we say, somewhat surprising. It turns out there is actually quite a big demand for COBOL programmers right now. Now, for people that might not know, I'm talking about Joe here, Ravi. Explain what COBOL is.
Yeah, so COBOL stands for Common Business Orientated Language, and it was basically a language that was developed in 1959. And it's an old computer language that was used to program all the business systems. Now, at the moment with the pandemic going on, there's need for healthcare workers, and there's also a need for welfare systems. So a lot of people are out of work, so they're all applying for welfare. Now, it happens that the American welfare system is based on COBOL and these old mainframe systems. But there's a real issue. And the issue is at the moment that there's 60 million lines of COBOL code in use at the moment. And they haven't taught it at the university since the 80s. So they've got no one to come in and help kind of program this stuff. And I was looking further into it, and I actually couldn't believe it, that you've got this really old programming language, and 43% of banking systems are built on it, and 95% of ATM swipes rely on COBOL code as well. So any That's COBOL great. Experts, you need to go and help out the American system here.
So anybody who learned how to do it in the 50s needs to get involved.
You know, I'm thinking about, I'm sure my mum used to program in COBOL. And she's not doing anything. She's just sitting in a back garden, sipping Prosecco at the moment in the sunshine. She could be making herself. I'm going to get on the phone after this. It does make you think, though. Because, I mean, all these kids are at, like, you know, college and uni, probably doing stuff like Python and JavaScript. Need to get on the case with COBOL. They could earn a fortune.
Well, here they're saying, you know, these are 40-year-old mainframes, and they're processing like thousands upon thousands of claims, and they're just being overloaded. They can't deal with it. They're used to a slow kind of pace and a steady stream.
You know, we've talked about it on the show before, the fact that a lot of these kind of, they call them legacy systems, are still running. I think one of the most concerning ones was the nuclear missiles that are actually still running on 8-inch floppy disks from the 1960s. So it doesn't surprise me at all that we've still got COBOL mainframes doing important work. But yeah, if you do know anyone who knows COBOL, get them on the case. There's work that needs to be done. So we'll put a link to that and all the other stories that we talk about in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, of course, there are lots of other brilliant retro gaming podcasts out there as well, including our great mates at Retro Asylum Podcast. I think they've been going longer than any other UK retro gaming podcast. And last week, they give us a really nice shout on their show.
Yeah, they did, because we're running a Patreon at the moment, and they kind of gave us a lovely shout, but also they're doing something fantastic. This is really funny. You know, at the moment you're kind of probably sitting at home doing a lot of lawn mowing and stuff like that. But,
yeah, I am.
Yeah, but now you can do it on your Spectrum Next. So there's a great game which is called Advanced Lawnmower Simulator, and this was actually a prank that was released in April 1988 for Your Sinclair by Duncan MacDonald, and he claimed to be called Gardensoft. That was his kind of name, and it wasn't software, it was grassware. So all this is a kind of simulator of you mowing a lawn. But what Retro Asylum have done, and Dean Swain has actually coded a new version of it for the Spectrum Next. So this is 32 years later. Garden Softer in association with Retro Asylum, and you can download the full title off their Google Drive. We'll provide a link, and they've kind of added the extra capabilities of the Spectrum Next. So there's a bit more color in there. It's not got so much color clash, but it's still essentially a lawn mowing simulator.
You know, I'm thinking would be incredible. You know, like he got the logo turtle on the BBC Micro. If you could hook like a real lawnmower up to your Spectrum Next and run this, and it could do the garden for you.
You see, that's what I actually thought it was going to be.
Well, do you remember that there was a lot of like joke simulators that came out? I remember there was Brick Simulator, and then there was a few sensible software ones like Sensible Train Spotting. There was like all of these really weird cult kind of strange remakes.
And it's good that, you know, to get new software for the Spectrum Next as well, especially when it's got that kind of legacy behind it, you know, that was a bit of a prank back in the day, that. So, good work. The guys from Retro Asylum, of course, will link that up in our show notes too. Now, Joe, you've been spending your time in isolation, completing a game over and over. How many times have you completed the new version of Resident Evil 3 in the last week?
I think last night was my 7th completion of it.
Wow.
Which has also meant I've platinumed the game now, so every single achievement, every single in-game reward as well. So I absolutely adore Resident Evil games, and I've been absolutely loving the Resident Evil 3 remake and obviously the Resident Evil 2 remake last year. So I am thrilled and at the same time a little bit torn about the decision by Capcom that they have announced that they are remaking Resident Evil 4 with a release date of 2022, which I'm really, really excited about. But like I say, I'm a little bit torn as well because of it's only 16 years old, so like I don't feel like it quite needs the remake like the other two did, because they were like 22 years old. Like, I don't know, like at what point do you start remaking it? But I am excited about it, and it's cool that they are, you know, they've been really successful with the remakes. You know, they sold like 6 million copies of Resident Evil 2. Resident Evil 3 is not doing quite as well, but they're saying they think it's due to the, you know, the global pandemic. But yeah, really excited about it. And they've got the same people who, you know, helped develop number two and number three remakes, and also the Devil May Cry 5 release as well. So it's the same team behind all of them. And they've also got the blessing from the original director of Resident Evil 4, Shinji Mikami, I think his name was. And they offered him to direct the remake as well, but he's graciously turned it down and said, you know, the guys who have worked on number two and three can do it. So I'm really excited about it. I don't know if you guys are familiar, but how the current Resident Evil games kind of play that over the shoulder, you know, third person look. Resident Evil 4 was kind of the first one to do that.
Oh, okay.
And kind of like invented that kind of style of gameplay back in like 2005. Well, not invented it, but, you know, was kind of like the pioneering game of it. So it's a bit like, does it need remaking? Because it's already like guarded as such a perfect game anyway, if that makes sense.
Had they skipped Code Veronica then? Because wasn't that before it?
Yeah, so Code Veronica was kind of like the unofficial version of Resident Evil 3, because that was always meant to be Resident Evil 3. And then Resident Evil 3 was just going to be Resident Evil Nemesis. But then it turned out in their contracts with Sony that they had to put the first three main title releases on PlayStation. So Code Veronica, which was for the Dreamcast, just became Code Veronica rather than Resident Evil 3. So the rumor was up until about two, three days ago, that Code Veronica was going to get remade for this, you know, 2022 release. But it's all coming out that's actually going to be Resident Evil 4. Now, personally, I feel like Resident Evil Code Veronica would have been the natural progression, like you've just said, because that's still played in like the fixed, well, not quite fixed camera, but, you know, like the tank controls, like the old school 90s style. Like,
yeah.
So that just felt like the natural progression for me, but they've skipped it, like you're saying, they're going straight to number four.
For me, this looks like kind of like the Doom remakes, like they're that high quality. And interestingly, I saw that they added an online game mode on a Resident Evil 3 as well.
Yeah, so with Resident Evil 3, you actually get two games in one. You get Resident Evil 3 and Resident Evil Resistance, which is like a completely separate game, but it's completely online, but it uses all the game assets from Resident Evil 2 and 3, so you can get all the weapons and stuff like that for the online for that. So it's pretty cool. It's a little glitchy because it's all online and, you know, you run off one person's server. So I'm hoping they fix that up. But yeah, I pray that, you know, this Resident Evil 4 is just as good as it is as number 2 and 3 for the remakes, because of, you know, Resident Evil 4 was such a good game anyway. And, you know, 2 and 3 were amazing games, but the remakes have been phenomenal. So I hope they do, you know, do it justice.
And I need to see Code Veronica. I play that so much on the Dreamcast. I'd love to get a new version of that again.
Yeah, Code Veronica, I didn't actually play it through until a couple of years ago because I didn't have a Dreamcast when I was a kid. And I didn't play it until a couple of years ago, and I really enjoyed it. So I would have liked to have seen, you know, the Code Veronica remake over the number 4 remake, and then possibly seen the 4 remake after that. But yeah, they're going straight forward. So who knows? We might still get the Code Veronica remake if Resident Evil 4 remake's just as successful as the other two remakes.
Put that pressure on, Joe. Keep those tweets.
Yeah, I'm going to keep it going. I'm going to definitely keep it going, making people buy it. Buy Resident Evil 3.
Now, actually, we're a bit excited about this weekend because we're going to be doing a little party on Sunday night, aren't we, with our Patreons. Going to be having our first patrons-only hangout on Sunday evening. So if you have backed us on Patreon, obviously, like we said at the start of the show, we appreciate the times are a little bit hard for everybody right now, but we do massively appreciate your support. We've been putting a few little exclusives up there, and we've been putting a few of the episodes out early, a few little bonus podcasts and live panels that we've done. And if you are around on Sunday night and you are a Patreon of ours, it would be great to get you on there. I think the plan is, what, just literally Sunday night, 8 o'clock, we're going to crack open a couple of beers and just chat about retro games for an hour or two.
You know,
yeah.
You guys, we should try and find some old photos of like our retro setups, or like us when we were younger with some dodgy technology or something. That'll be good fun.
That'd be good fun. I don't know if I'll be able to fish them out from my mum's with everything that's going on, but I'm going to sit in my games room and show off a couple of things. You know,
room tour,
big-headed. Yeah, bit of a room tour maybe.
And there may be a kitchen as well if we've got like a spare hour or two.
So people can see how big it really is.
The labyrinth.
Well, of course, the reason that we do have a Patreon is because even though we are doing this remotely this week, this is not the way we prefer to do the show. We're actually trying to get a fund together to build our own studio, because usually we do the podcast in the studio that I'm in on my own at the moment, but we want to get our own built so we can do more of the show. You know, we can do pretty much, we've got access access to a studio 24 hours a day. It's going to mean that we can get a lot more flexibility with guests. We can create more content for you. Video we want to do as well. We've got some big plans for the future. So thank you so much for everybody who supported us on Patreon. Of course, we are getting through as many shouts as we can each week and getting you guys in the Hall of Fame. This week, we want to say a big thank you to Gary Broadhead,
Scott Brian Fraser,
Andrew Lee,
Ian Wilkinson,
and Gary Hever,
who all made donations into our Patreon, and you can do the same. You'll find the link on our website at theretrohour.com. Right, we'll have more news for you on next week's show, and next we are going to get the story of the British Home Computer Wars and that incredible docudrama, Micromen, with this week's special guest, Tony Saint. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. Now, this week we're going to be joined by Tony Saint. Now, Tony is an award-winning screenwriter for television and the man who was a writer on one of my all-time favourite dramas, Micromen, which was a brilliant dramatisation of the early 80s home computer wars here in Britain. So let's welcome him onto the show. Welcome to the Retro Hour, Tony Saint.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, before we get into the story of Micromen, which I must say I've probably watched more times than I should probably admit, it's one of my all-time favourites. I know before that you were working on the Long Walk to Finchley, which is about Margaret Thatcher in the years before she became Prime Minister. So, I mean, tell us a bit about your kind of background and other work that we might know you for.
Well, I'm what I'd call a jobbing screenwriter, so I kind of take the work where it comes, but I've been quite lucky since I started doing this that I've had a nice variety of things to work on. And so the Micromen and the Mrs. Thatcher film were both examples of the BBC4 single dramas that they don't do anymore, unfortunately, because they were a great kind of school for learning, for learning the craft, if you like. Mm-hmm. I did three of them actually in total. So I did the Thatcher film, which was a great success at the time. And Andrea Riseborough played Margaret Thatcher to great acclaim. I did a little film about the MP's expenses scandal as well, which was quite a lot of fun to do. And then subsequently onto that, I moved on to probably what you call some bigger projects. I worked on a big show for Sky and HBO called Strike Back, which was a complete antithesis of something like Micromen, which is, as we'll come to, made for about 50p. Yeah. and more recently, I've been working on the new television version of Das Boot, which I did the first series of, which was on Sky Atlantic in the UK and in Germany, where it was produced, which has been a great experience and a really exciting show to work on. I'm doing another series of that at the moment. And as ever, looking for any other opportunities that might come my way. But it's one of these things that, I used to do a different job. I used to work for the Home Office before I became a screenwriter. So I didn't really like that so much. So I'm one of these guys who thanks his lucky stars every day that he's not doing that anymore. And it gets away with making a living by coming up with daft stories, is the way I think of it. Yeah.
Well, interestingly, you're quite unique in terms of guests that we have on this podcast, because you're not actually much of a technologist yourself, are you?
I am a self-declared ignoramus when it comes to this stuff. So, as you say, I have a little whiff of imposter syndrome around me being on your show, but I'll do my best. But yeah, when it comes to the actual technical side of it, yeah, I am completely devoid of any knowledge, really. And I, in a way, I suppose I embody what I think of as this. I know there was a magazine called Sinclair User, which was referred to in Micromen, but I am a sort of the classic Sinclair user in that I know absolutely nothing about what I'm doing. I'm the pure end user when it comes to this kind of machinery. So and the very sophisticated tech that you and I are talking on today, because of the current circumstances, is a case in point. It up and I'm going, wow, that's amazing, but I have no idea how it works.
We don't need to know, as long as it works. Well, I mean, going back to that kind of era, the golden age of home computing, if you like. I mean, did you own a computer or a console yourself as a kid, or use them?
No, I mean, I was very much one of the kids who was desperate to get one but never did. I don't know why it was. My parents just never quite got round to getting me one. So I used to often go around to a mate, especially in the summer holidays. I remember this a lot because I guess I was sort of 12, 13, 14 across this period. Spend the whole day at my mate Ian Tarkin's house playing Football Manager, was the game I remember most vividly.
Yeah.
On the Spectrum, I think it must have been, because it was colours, yeah. And you'd set it up, wouldn't you? And then I used to, the bit where I used to play the game between you changing your team and whatever it was, and they had these fantastically sort of basic graphics of a football match. And yet, bizarrely enough, it was always incredibly exciting because you sort of didn't know the result, obviously, being Football Manager. And I remember that very vividly. And the noise the bloody thing used to make when you put the cassette in. That may have been the reason my parents never got one. Perhaps it was just because they couldn't stand that sound, which in hindsight, I completely understand, actually. but it was always just slightly out of reach. I'm not quite sure why that was. I think I always, probably because I had friends who had them, it was never top of my kind of wish list at Christmas or birthdays. I do remember one thing we had in the house was we had what we called the TV game, which I suppose was Pong, is what it's known as these days.
Yeah,
we used to have that, and that was probably 77 or something. My parents got us that, and we thought that was amazing. You know, so I was sort of at the right age at the right time to really kind of be in the. I suppose I was right in the sort of the sights of these people. You know, by the time one of the interesting things about the film, which we'll talk about this, is how it morphed, obviously, from being one kind of phenomenon into another kind of phenomenon, because it was a technical phenomenon that turned into a kind of entertainment phenomenon, wasn't it, really, in the
yeah.
whole games explosion. And so I was at that age where I was sort of, as I say, right in the crosshairs of that, although I never actually had the chance to own one. And it's, no, I don't dwell on that, Dan. I mean, it's just one of those things that, you know, I wake up in the night wishing I had a Spectrum, you know.
It's never too late.
And I'll tell you what, I wish I had one now because it'd be worth quite a lot of money, I think.
Yeah, it's crazy, actually, isn't it? The things that we threw out back in the day is now suddenly become valuable antiques all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, that ZX80, that brick thing, I mean, it's hilarious that's worth, so they're so valuable now. Even at the time, they looked like, they looked pretty tatty at the time, I thought. Anyway.
Right. Well, let's talk about Micromanx. And originally that was called Syntax Era was the original name for it, I read. How did you That's get right, on board yeah. with the project and what kind of attracted you to work on it?
I mean, it's not that part of the story is fairly straightforward. I mean, I was approached. I think the it was on the back of having written the film about Margaret Thatcher, which like Micromanx, the thing they both have in common, I think, is they both take a sort of tongue-in-cheek approach to, you know, a historical period and a historical story. Perhaps more so with a Mrs. Thatcher story, that you think you have an understanding of this person and their life, and it was a great opportunity to write a film that showed you a different side to their history and a different side to their character, or made the audience look at it from a slightly different perspective. But I think the kind of comic element to that was what appealed to the producers in approaching me about doing Clive St. Clair, which I think was right. I think the way to do it somehow, because of the sort of slightly kind of, there's something sort of quite homely about the British computer industry that it's not IBM, isn't it? It felt small and a bit more parochial. And in a way, that sort of lent itself to a kind of lighter approach, I think. So I was approached about it. And as you say, the title at the time was Syntax Era, which wasn't my idea. I didn't, you know, that was the title that was attached to the project. And I think it was a little bit too techie a title, to my taste. And I'm glad we changed it. You know, I was obviously, you know, I obviously responded to that because of the age I'd been at the time. I responded to that idea, that world, that story, because I kind of implicitly understood the impact those machines had had. But also, I think what really hit home with me was, as I said earlier, what a scriptwriter is looking for, which is a great sort of central dynamic to the story. And this story about Clive Sinclair and Chris Curry, the mentor and the protege who fall out, who go their own ways, who are basically constantly being pushed by their rivalry into disaster, is such a great kind of arc. You couldn't wish for anything more to get your teeth into as a dramatist, really. So those are the key things. And obviously I saw, particularly in Clive Sinclair, I don't know much about Chris Curry before that, but particularly in Clive Sinclair, you, again, as with Mrs. Thatcher, you're sort of taking an iconic figure on and kind of trying to get under their skin a bit, you know. And in a way, I suppose, I mean, Micromanx is certainly guilty is the right word, but it certainly points up some of the absurdities of Sir Clive's character, as well as hopefully some of the positive sides to him as well. But I think that those are the sort of elements that kind of appeal to me. So it's sort of slightly a slightly tongue-in-cheek kind of irreverent take on, you know, what we look back on now as a bit of a British institution. But I think there's always a little bit more to tell. And one of the interests in doing the show, I think, was trying to get into that rivalry and get into that. It's almost a Shakespearean story if you think about
yeah.
it. I mean, it has that kind of scale of emotion and, as I said, the rivalry and that relationship fracturing. And then actually, I mean, one of the scenes I had a quick look at the show again before talking to you, and one of the scenes I like the best is actually the final scene that the two men have in the pub at the end, because being able to sort of draw some poignancy out of it as well, I think was something that that I was hoping to do. And that scene always makes me kind of smile. And there's a gentleness to it, which I like too, you know.
Yeah, like they've got through the battle zone and the friends again at the end, almost.
Yeah, and I think they've both paid the price, haven't they? I think that one of the fascinating things about the story as we tell it, that I honed in on, was very much the idea, as I said, there's this fundamental rivalry between them. But what's so fascinating is that the seeds of their destruction in both men's cases were in trying to emulate the other, and I found that so interesting about it, you know. So as you'll know, Acorn it became obsessed with trying to produce a machine that was basically for the common man, that was something equivalent to what Sinclair was doing, where Sinclair was desperate to be taken seriously by the computer hierarchy, if you like, you know. And so he produced the, I think it was the QL, wasn't it, the quantum
leap? Yes.
That was the machine that basically proved to be his downfall. They actually departed from their true path, if you like, again, motivated by their rivalry. And that was what brought them down, as almost, I mean, you could argue it's a sort of Greek tragedy of sorts, you know, hubris and nemesis striking you at the end. And I think that was there's a lovely symmetry to that in the story, which made it a very compelling story to want to write.
Well, were you aware of this kind of rivalry going into this then, or was that kind of a narrative that developed? And because I thought it was really interesting that it focused on that, and I think it was definitely the right thing to do, rather than focusing so much on the companies and the technology, it was more of a personal story.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, before I was approached about the show, I didn't know anything about the rivalry. I didn't know anything about the Baron of Beef incident. Shocking violence. Where Clive Sinclair attacks Chris Curry and there's a punch up in the pub, which was actually that was the starting point for, I think, when I got sent the material, that was the first thing. It led to a fight in a pub in Cambridge. I thought, right, well, I like the sound of this. This sounds great fun. And if you go back from there and you see what led to that, you know, that was a great kind of, in a sense, that's the crescendo of the whole piece, is where they have this slightly preposterous punch up in this pub. But I didn't know much about the rivalry. I didn't really know a lot about Acorn Computers, to be honest with you. And I don't know if I'd had any dealings with BBC Computers at the school I went to in Newcastle, where I grew up. I had no recollection of that. So that was all new to me. But I think I just instinctively kind of reacted to that central premise. And again, I think that there's something about the punch up in the pub, which is so quintessentially British, and sort of, you know, amusing in its own right. I mean, you know, sort of think if it was, I know there's these shows on Netflix and other American shows about computer startups, and everything is dialed up to 11. And, you know, if there was going to be a fight in one of those shows, it would probably end up with guns being fired at people.
Yeah.
Whereas in a British version, it's like a rolled up newspaper hitting someone over the head. And I rather like that sort of kind of,
like fisticuffs, isn't it?
Yes, we're pathetic, I think, is the right word, isn't it? That sort of kind of like very, very English kind of understatement. But having said that, the stakes for the characters are just as high, I think, as they are in any of those American dramas, because these guys lost everything. And I think as Herman Hauser character says in the film, you know, that what's great about the people who work in that is they're very smart people, and they'll find something else. And I think it was in the script, as I remember, but obviously I didn't know the details, but it's in the script that as he says that line behind him, there's some early kind of ideas about the ARM chip, which was this chip, wasn't it, that went on to become ubiquitous, that these guys at Acorn developed. Is that ARM chip? ARM chip, is that what it's called?
Yeah, ARM chip. Yeah, it's in every phone in the world now, isn't it? And everything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, the idea of the show is the great thing about that story as well is it obviously picks up Clive Sinclair from his previous existence as Sinclair Radionics, and this guy who was the kind of inventor that he talks about, you know, he talks at the end of the film about the British inventor being the man who scuttles to his shed with this great idea that's going to change the world. The Clive Sinclair who kind of, that's my sense of how he started out in a way, and then he became the Clive Sinclair that we all knew in this heyday. But for him and the other characters, the story doesn't really end with the end of the film. It's just, that's just a snapshot. And then for the Steve Ferbers and the Sophie Wilsons of this world, of course, the story almost just begins there. That's the beginning of their story. It has a long way and much greater heights to go to. So,
and I thought that Alexander Armstrong and Martin Freeman were perfect in the roles as well. I mean, how were they chosen for it then?
Yeah, you go through a casting system. I mean, you know, when you do a show like this, you hire a casting director, and various options are put up there. And I mean, obviously at the time, Martin Freeman, I guess he must have been between jobs, because I mean, he's gone on to do a few, you know, he'd finished The Office then, I guess. So, and I don't know whether he, I don't know whether he'd been cast as the Hobbit at that point. I can't remember. But obviously, it was, you know, it turned out to be quite a coup to have him in the film, bearing in mind what he's gone on to do since. And Alexander Armstrong was a casting director's idea, which I thought. And I was always a huge fan of Armstrong and Miller. And also, he's actually like a lot of great, you know, sketch duos. They're actually very, very good actors because you sort of have to be, because you've got to inhabit a lot of different roles, you know. And I was thinking people like Mel Smith from Not 9 o'clock News and Griffith Jones are actually very good actors as well as being very good comedians. And I thought he was a great idea. And of course, he has that wonderful comic timing, which just is a joy to write for. And coming back to that final scene, I mean, again, I just watched it recently, and that final line Clive has where he says to Chris Curry, you know, I'm thinking about designing a flying car.
Yeah.
The way he says flying car, yeah, it just always cracks me up. But that's, you know, that's a great skill to have. And his comic timing is magnificent. And in a way, I regret that he doesn't do more acting now. He's now Mr. Game Show host. I think that's a bit of a loss to the nation, personally. But yes, I mean, he pulled it off really well. And I think, obviously, you know, we cast him for the comic potential. You know, I mean, obviously, with Clive Sinclair, I won't go to hell for saying this. There's a certain degree of pomposity there, I think, that mm-hmm. that you want to kind of exploit. And I think he did a very good job of that. And there's a couple of particular scenes where he's he's gloriously funny, I think. It's very funny. The scene where he comes past Chris Curry on his C5 in the middle of the night. That always makes me laugh.
Well, I mean, when you were researching the characters, I mean, how did you go about that? Did you actually meet Chris Curry or Clive Sinclair when writing or people that knew them or what?
Well, there's a story. I was due to meet Clive Sinclair. It's one of my regrets it didn't happen, unfortunately, for personal reasons. The producers did go and meet him, and I was due to go, but I couldn't, unfortunately, because of a bereavement. So I missed that opportunity, and I missed the opportunity to be in his flat on top of Trafalgar Square. So I didn't get the chance to meet him, but I did meet Chris Curry. I met Chris Curry. It's 10 years on now, so I can probably tell you. I met Chris Curry during the shoot because when he read the script, he was a little bit concerned, and he wanted to set a few things straight. So I met him. That was the context in which I met him. What he didn't know at the time was that actually half the show had been shot by that point. So some of his concerns were already in the can, as it were. But I had met Steve Ferber. I met him at Manchester over a Chinese meal, which was great. And I got a lot of insight. And he was very supportive of the whole thing. I think he loved the project. And he was very complimentary about it after he'd seen it, because he very kindly said, and this was very much one of my hopes, that it really, really for him caught the spirit of the time. You know, that kind of, that very sort of happy-go-lucky sort of doing it by the seat of your pants atmosphere that we create in the middle of the show when they're trying to build the spec for the BBC computer. He said that for him just sent him reeling back in time to what it was actually like, which is great to hear, because you think you've really captured the essence of something when you hear that. I think one of my other regrets was I never got to meet Herman Hauser, because I think I would have just enjoyed meeting him, but that didn't happen. So in terms of the actual personnel, I met one or two of them, yeah. But sometimes as a screenwriter, it's sometimes better to keep your distance, if I'm honest with you, because, you know, they can't get to you that way, Dan, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, we often find when we do this show, you know, we'll talk to different people who work for the same company and at the same time, and you often get conflicting accounts of what happened, and memories kind of fade or play tricks. Was there much of that then that you had to kind of get together into one, like, kind of story? And
interesting. I don't know if you've seen that. I only picked this up because I YouTubed. I did a naughty thing, and I watched a bit of it on YouTube the other week. But I noticed that there's actually a film that's now available of Ferber and Chris Curry and Herman Hauser watching the film.
Yes.
Commenting on it as they go. And it's very interesting that sometimes they do that in the course of the YouTube thing. One of them will say, you know, oh, I don't remember that. The other will say, oh, that definitely happened. That definitely happened. So I think that's the vagaries of time, isn't it? I mean, I think, largely speaking, most of the research material came from the two or three books that I had that followed the course quite. I mean, one of them was a bit too technical for me, but a couple of them were just very good books about the history and the time. And I did a bit of trawling through newspapers and digging out some material. It was a while ago now, so I don't remember exactly how all the research was done. But I mean, you know, I look at it now, and from what I can see from the general comments on it, it's reasonably. It seems to have stood the test in terms of the story stands up to pretty much what it was like. We've taken a few liberties, unquestionably. We took some dramatic license there, But the fundamentals of it, I think are true to the spirit of the story and the spirit of the times. And I mean, it says in the film at some point that Hermann Hauser was doing a PhD in oxidization. Now, I must have got that from somewhere because I wouldn't have put that in. But then apparently he wasn't doing a PhD in oxidization. That's completely wrong. So
right.
I put my hand up to that one. But most of the time, I think we got the details quite right. And there were people on the show, on the production side, who were much more technically savvy than me. And I think they had a clearer understanding of some of the details about the actual sort of the technical side of the story. But what I have learned from this film is that when you write something about in this kind of area, if you don't get your facts right, people let you know about it. I mean, there's some remarkable comments about the film. I remember one guy had posted a comment somewhere saying, yeah, I really enjoyed the film, but that cabling outside the office in scene whatever is clearly 10 years out of date. And I thought, wow, that guy is watching the show looking at the cabling. I mean, that's impressive, you know.
Well, talking about moments in there that were kind of, you know, exaggerated slightly to make them more dramatic, I thought there were some great moments there, for example, when Herman was cutting the wire like a bomb disposal expert might do as the BBC are walking up the stairs. I mean, I imagine, you know, moments like that were kind of played for the dramatic side of it, but I thought they did really add to the story.
Well, you would think so. In actual fact, I mean, that's a case in point. That was actually much nearer to the truth than you might think, apparently, that they really were down to the wire and the BBC guys were coming up the stairs and they still hadn't got the thing working. And there was some, again, I mean, I struggled to really understand the kind of the exact details of what was going on. So I sort of basically, you know, wrote it as a kind of, like, as you said, like a sort of bomb disposal sequence. But there was effectively a kind of moment where Herman had to do something equivalent to that. And it literally was, these guys are coming up the stairs. If we don't get this thing working, we are screwed. And what are we going to do? Let's try this, bang. And the bloody thing came to life. So in actual fact, that from what I, and again, I think if you refer to that YouTube film of them watching it, I think they that's one of the areas where they said it wasn't that far away from reality. Ironic, but in opposition to that, the scene where they're all eating Chinese takeaways with kind of tools, apparently that never really happened. But I just thought that was quite fun, so I'll put that in.
Well, I mean, did you find the era in general quite interesting to write for? And, you know, visiting the early 80s always seems like a fun time to visit for a show. I mean, it was kind of like you said before, you know, Clive Sinclair, that kind of last era of the eccentric British inventor. Mm. It seemed like,
yeah,
it was quite,
I mean,
a fun,
I mean,
time.
Yeah, I mean, for someone of my age, you know, as well, it was a kind of, they were my kind of salad days, really, you know, being that age. And I think that was generally just a sort of quite exciting time. I think just coming out of that decade of the 70s, although I look back on the 70s very fondly these days, but I think at the time, I was thinking the 80s would offer all sorts of kind of new opportunities. In a funny sort of way, these kind of slightly absurd, silly computers that were all part of that. You know, I think if you look back at them now, that we just laugh so much about what they were capable of doing, but they did sort of open a window to a whole world of opportunity, didn't they? Or a whole different way of seeing things. And I think they were part of an expectation that the world was going to change in some radical ways, you know, especially when you're that age and you're young and you're looking forward the whole time. You get to the age I'm at now and you have a slightly different perspective on things, don't you? But I think that was definitely played into it, you know, and all the nice, yeah, the 80s is a good period to do on TV, especially when you haven't got a great budget, because you can kind of do it relatively inexpensively, unlike, say, even the 50s now is hard to do because, you know. But I think the 80s still doesn't look that unlike today, you know, and the clothes are very particular and you know, all those sort of stylings are kind of very relatively easy to do, but also very effective at the same time. But I was these are very much my formative years. And these computers were definitely a huge part of it. I mean, I remember that, you know, that it didn't seem like it was going to be, I mean, of course, in one sense, it was a fad because these machines were quickly kind of superseded by other things, but it felt like a fad. But at the same time, you realize now that it was the beginning of something that is utterly, utterly universal and ubiquitous now. And you or I are effectively talking through equipment that, if you, it's a perhaps a tangential link, but is distantly connected to those kind of machines, which is quite an extraordinary thought, really.
Yeah, those, you know, Sinclair and Acorn machines are really, you know, for a lot of people, they were the first introduction to computers. So it spawned a whole generation of computer programmers and graphic artists and all sorts.
But I think what's so interesting as well about them is, you know, what we as a population do with these devices. And I think, you know, there's a slight, I mean, it's not melancholy, it's not the right word, but there's a slight poignancy in the idea of, you know, these guys putting these computer kits together for the enthusiast who wants to understand how these things work. And I had friends, you know, when I was growing up, I had friends who were those kind of guys, and they understood that stuff, and they were incredibly smart and technically minded. And yet it very quickly becomes about the end user, about, you know, consumerism, about playing games, about entertainment. We sort of, and that is also something that has exploded. And that's really what, obviously, computers are kind of like, I don't know what percentage of time people spend doing other things, but I imagine most of it's about entertainment, most of it's about pleasure. Without, and I, you know, I'm a case in point, someone who uses these machines without a clue how they work. I haven't got a clue how any of them work. And there is a sort of slight sadness in that I think that more people don't understand it. And I think that spirit of the very early days, you know, Chris Curry's idea of building, you know, the first, I forget the name of it, but the was it the Mark 14? Sort of pre-ZX80. In fact, the ZX80, I think, was just a kind of boxed-up version of this computer, which is the one that Chris Curry sort of started out with. The idea of something that you would have as a computer would primarily be there to teach you how to understand computers. I think there's a sort of beauty in that idea, which we've largely lost, I think, as these phenomenal machines do ever more phenomenal things on our behalf. Our inability to kind of understand them is, you know, and obviously when the machines do rise up and take over, you know, we may come to rue that day. You know, I'm the guy who always says please and thank you to Alexa, which we've just got in our house recently, because I'm convinced that when the machines do rise up, the people who've been polite to them, they'll probably give them an easier ride. I don't know what you think.
I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords.
Yeah, exactly. Remember when I said thank you and good morning?
I think that point you made there about, you know, the fact that these machines weren't designed for what we generally ended up using them for, I think you captured that really well with Clive Sinclair's frustrations when, you know, he mentioned that people are using it to play Jet Set Effing Willy in the script exactly. as well. I mean, did you kind of see that when you were writing it then, that this was like a frustration of his?
Yes, totally. And I think that was very much a lovely element of the story as well, which is that he, you know, it is that hubristic thing that, as I mentioned earlier, that although his idea as evinced in the show, or as characterized in the show, was to put a computer in every household in Britain, even if people had no idea what it was for, his downfall comes from wanting to be taken seriously, or wanting to produce a computer that was taken seriously by people. So I think there's a sort of, you know, so in a way that is that very kind of tragic idea of someone who has succeeded, but has succeeded on the wrong terms in their own mind and wants to be perceived in a different way. And I think there's something so universal about that idea. It's the human condition, that, isn't it, really, that you get what you want, but then you want something else. You want the other thing. And I think that's what's so rich about that as a character idea. And I think in a way, you know, he I think the reality of the situation demonstrated that. I mean, it made a massive catastrophic business error, didn't he, really, as did Chris Curry in the opposite direction. And that's irrespective of the world of tech and the milieu and how clever they all are. That's those universal human characteristics that make it a good drama, I think, as opposed to just being a show about computers, if you know what I mean.
Yes, you think, like, you know, Clive could have just kind of sat back and sold it as a game machine and raked in the millions, but he's trying to do stuff like, you know, the watch absolutely. That you cover in there, and the C5 that he, you know, obviously wasted loads of money on. So, I mean, there is a lot of tragedy in amongst that success.
Well, exactly. And I think that, you know, he had this reputation, which was deserved, I think, for you know, it's all about elegance, it's all about presentation. In that sense, he was ahead of his time in that respect, because he was very design-oriented and all of this miniaturization stuff and you know, and that whole ethos is very interesting and particular to him. But interestingly, that yes, he departed from his own path of success because he wanted to be viewed in a way different to the way he's being viewed. I find that very interesting. And I think we all, to some extent, can relate to that. And, you know, I think it's a great curse, I think. It's not one I suffer from too much, I think, but it's a curse to want to be taken too seriously. And I can see from someone like Clive Sinclair with his, you know, with his certain degree of self-regard that he obviously has, but that's a difficult thing to live with. And I think it's a very telling and very interesting kind of character dynamic that sort of, you know, runs underneath all the kind of like the more fun stuff that the film, you know, does with him. I mean, he had a pretty notorious temper, yeah. Which is something we don't hold back on the film. We see quite a bit of that. But also at the same time, I think, as I said about the scene at the end, I think fundamentally there was a kind of, he didn't bear grudges, and he could be very loyal to people he respected and liked as well. So I think that try as much as possible to sort of present a rounded kind of version of him. But, you know, the film is primarily meant to be a kind of rollicking piece of entertainment, and it sort of developed this kind of second life with the good listeners of your podcast and others, you know, who just are huge fans of that world. So it's great that it's kind of had this kind of extended sort of interest. And 10 years on, people still talk to me about it. People in the business come up to me and say how much they love Microman. I'm thinking, really? Yeah. But it chimes with a lot of people, particularly of my age, I think, who lived through that excitement of that computer boom, you know, and playing endless games of Space Invaders, whatever it was you played on the thing.
I mean, yeah, were there any kind of stories or moments that you wanted to explore that you couldn't or that didn't make the final cut?
Well, there was one in particular, and we did remove something at Clive Sinclair's request, which I think was you know, perfectly fine, and he didn't want us to put it in, so we took it out. And it was a scene about, he got divorced from his wife during the period of the story, and just about the only thing that I could remember ever being able to do on a Spectrum was that thing where you put in 10 something something, and then you put in 20 go to 10, and it would scroll down the screen.
Yeah,
remember that? Yeah, ring a bell? Is that right? That's, you know, and so I had a scene where you know, it was a bit cheeky. It was a little scene where his wife asked Clive for a divorce by doing that, basically.
Wow.
And so the screen as I want. And I thought it was just a bit of fun, really. But he did ask us that we didn't put that in. So we took that out. And the film wasn't affected by that, you know. So but I think, you know, that just to demonstrate the fact that we are sensitive to people's kind of, you know, feelings about that kind of thing. There was no great loss to the show, that didn't happen. But he did, yeah. They did get. I mean, I think all the main protagonists got it. Were shown it, and I mean, Chris Curry claims in that YouTube video that he'd never seen the film until that point. And you can make of that what you will. But I think he certainly was shown a script before it was shot, and so everyone had. And I think I do remember Herman Hauser somewhere saying the reason why Clive Sinclair declared himself not to be a fan of the film was because it kind of presented him as he actually was. I'll leave that remark hanging in the air.
That's interesting. So I did read that, you know, that mainly from the Acorn side of it, you know, that they're all quite a big fan of it, that they loved it and they thought it was actually quite accurate. But yeah, I did read that after that Clive wasn't a fan of it. Did he get to see it before it went out though? And did he give you any feedback or?
Well, he did see it, yes. He was given a copy to watch before it was broadcast. And so he did have a sort of right of reply, if you like, and asked for that scene to come out. I mean, I think that the smart thing, you know, and I think he more or less did this. And I certainly, when I worked on a film about Mrs. Thatcher, obviously you contact the estate, and you, I think, no, I'm sorry, Mrs. Thatcher was still alive. Lady Thatcher was still alive when the film was aired. So we contacted her office and we said, we're going to do this film. And I think, you know, actually, you know, these films come and go. And it's quite interesting that Mike Rowan's had this kind of extra life because most cases it's all, you know, there's a film about you gets made. Maybe it's a little bit critical or takes a poke at you. And a week later, it's forgotten, you know.
Yeah.
So the smart thing to do is to just let it happen, because in the long term, it doesn't really amount to very much. And I'm, you know, as the guy who wrote the thing, I'm fully conscious of that as well. So I don't think there was too much trouble over it. I think when you see this sort of the tone of it, I mean, you know, it's not a film that was designed to be taken terribly seriously. It was entertaining. We've got our tongue in our cheek, quite evidently, and I think that always helps in these circumstances, because, you know, unless you, it's sort of potentially a bit of an own goal to be too critical of something like Microman, because there's a danger you look a bit petty, I think.
Yeah.
Because it's not a kind of it's not intended to be a searing indictment of anything or anybody. It's just trying to tap into that kind of moment.
Well, did you have a preference over Sinclair or Acorn? Like, which side you thought should have won the battle when writing?
Not really. I think that one of the great things about the story is that you can see it from both sides. And I suppose at the root of the story is the break up between Chris Curry and Clive Sinclair, which I think you would probably look at sort of objectively and say, well, it didn't seem like Clive Sinclair was. I don't think he came out of that smelling of roses when this guy who worked for him for so long and was so devoted to him, they'd fallen out over some work thing. I suppose that's one point I'd make. But at the same time, I think Chris Curry sort of in the film anyway, the Chris Curry character's kind of desire to trump Sinclair is his sort of Achilles heel as well. So, you know, I think in a way, there is a nice balance on either side of the story between them. And I think that kind of parallel story of one company that's a serious computer company trying to get popular and a popular computer company trying to get serious, doing it to each other. It is, and again, I mean, there's a scene in the film where Chris Curry is looking at three pieces of advertising, isn't he, for his computer towards the end of the story. And he pointedly picks on the one that's knocking Sinclair.
Yeah,
and I think in a way you sort of that to my mind that certainly balances the kind of that balances how you might feel about the kind of the earlier breakup to some extent.
You capture the misfortune there as well with the Electron that was actually a good machine, but the timing was just wrong with it too.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean that's a huge part of the. I think that's true, but if I remember correctly, they overreached enormously, and they tried to get into the American market, didn't they? I think that was their big mistake. But I suppose they have to expand because the British market's only ever going to be so big. I understand that. But it was just that idea that the whole bottom fell out of the computer market altogether. And I suppose looking in hindsight, when you look at those machines and what they could do, that felt kind of inevitable somehow, didn't it? I don't know, that the machines couldn't really move quickly enough for the market. And I suppose their limitations were kind of cruelly exposed, you know.
Well, I think it captured the look of that era really well. As we know, we saw the old, like, the shots of how W.H. Smith used to look. And then there was that section where they mixed in the old footage of the BBC Micro Live programme from the early 80s.
Yes.
And then seamlessly cut it in with, like, you know, the characters. Did they recreate the sets for that then? And was that a challenge to make it appear seamless?
I think it was probably less of a challenge than you might think because in that case it was a TV studio. So I guess it didn't look too difficult. I mean, yeah, it was all pretty skillfully done, actually. I mean, one comment I'd make about the film is that I think when I watch it again now, I think there was probably a slight over-reliance on kind of documentary footage and the money program and stuff. I think we had some of that in the script, but I think there was a bit more of it ended up in the show than I felt was helpful. But because I think this is sometimes the danger that it jars you out of the drama. You know, if the less of that stuff you use, the better. But I thought that was a, you know, and Sophie and Steve Fibber were doing that at the time. They were basically sort of like gluing these things together while they were broadcasting live, probably in those days, you know. So all that sense of excitement and, as I said, that seat of the pants stuff is great. But I think in terms of, I mean, as I said before, I mean, these BBC Four shows were great. There was a lot of very good ones that came out when they must have stopped them about 7 or 8 years ago. But there was a little kind of this great burst of creativity around them. And a lot of them were done for very, very small budgets. So actually, in actual fact, it's, you know, the look of it is a great testament to the skill of the people on the production who are invariably the unsung heroes of these shows, to be honest with you. You know, people like me and directors and, you know, cast get a lot of the sort of the kudos and everything, but the people who make them, you know, use that word with the capital M, make the shows are the unsung heroes, you know. And I think Microman is a real case in point.
Well, obviously, you know, it's been over a decade now, 11 years ago since it came out, and it's obviously become a cult classic now, really, hasn't it? Avid, yeah, are you kind of surprised at that then, the level of interest it still has?
I suppose I'm surprised. I always figured that it would appeal very strongly to a coterie of tech fiends, if that's the right word. But I did remember thinking at the time, you know, this is a real hostage to fortune, because these people really know what they're talking about. and I haven't got a clue. So, you know, and if we make mistakes here, they're going to let us know about it, which has definitely been the case. But all power to their elbow. I think it's great. And I think it's great to have been involved in something has struck such a chord with so many people, you know. And, you know, it doesn't often happen, actually. I mean, you know, as I say, this business I work in, one of the great things, the greatest thing about it and the most terrible thing about it is the same thing, which is, you've spent 2 years working on a show in some cases, then it goes out and it's forgotten about the next day because there's something else coming along that's on at 9 o'clock the following night, if you know what I mean. Whereas this thing has just sort of had a life of its own and outlived its kind of very modest kind of beginnings and its very modest genesis into something that's made, and you know, the fact that it's made a lot of people happy and they've enjoyed it, and hopefully in some cases it's turned people on to you know, to the world of retro tech and the shows like yours. Well, that's incredibly, incredibly satisfying to think of. You know?
And obviously, there's that I imagine unofficial version of it on YouTube that people can check out as well anytime they want.
I couldn't possibly comment on that.
And the video of Chris Curry, Steve Ferber, and Herman Hauser watching it on the 10th anniversary. I'll put those in our show notes if people want to check them out.
I mean, all right, great.
Personally, yeah. Have you got any plans to do any more like kind of technology stories in the future? Do you think, or is that something you'll revisit?
I can't say that there are any in the near future that I can see coming over the hill. I mean, I'm interested in. You know, I like the idea of sort of science fiction of a slightly more kind of social kind of type. You know, I think that there's been an enormous amount of stuff about artificial intelligence and robots, and to my mind, that market's been a bit flooded. You know, But I think there is some. You know, I think Black Mirror is an interesting show. I think sometimes that when some of the technical questions that poses can be very intriguing. I think the tendency now is to think of it as a problem, isn't it, rather than as a solution. So I suppose so much of it's dystopian. It would be quite nice to find something that perhaps shows it in a slightly more positive light. And I know that some. I mean, I don't know if I haven't watched it personally. There's a show. Is it called *Halt and Catch Fire*?
Yes, I watched the whole thing actually.
Sort of, and is it fair to call it an American Micro-Man? It's probably not.
Well, it's kind of this group of people who invent everything from the personal computer to the internet to the mobile phone. But yeah, it is a good watch.
So it's slightly bigger in scale than Micro-Man. Yeah. So So obviously that's kind of been done, and I think that even in its own way, I suppose something like Stranger Things has that 80s whiff about it that we try to do. So yeah, I think that I'm interested in how this stuff affects people socially. I mean, I, you know, as a father of two teenage kids, I mean, I don't need much reminding of that every day of my life. They've got their faces, you know, basically glued to a screen of some description. But I think, you know, I try not to be too downbeat about tech. You know, I try to see the positive, although I find myself kind of, as I get a bit older, sort of slightly retreating from it at the same time, you know. And it's funny with this situation that we're all in at the moment, where in a way, when there's so much less traffic around and you can hear the birds singing in the trees outside the house, that you sort of think back to those days before these machines existed and what my earlier childhood was like, you know, and how much things have changed. I mean, you know, I was thinking about, you know, my father, he lived from 1929 to about 2-3 years ago. Just thinking about the changes that someone like him has seen in his lifetime is absolutely extraordinary, you know.
Well, see, look at Micro-Man, that was only 35 years ago, right? It's nothing in terms of human history, but it just feels like stuff's come on so fast.
And you've got computers with one kilobyte of memory or something, whatever it is, compared to what we have now, and everyone's clapping their hands in amazement at that, you know. It's extraordinary. But yes, I think it's interesting writing, you know, generally speaking, it's quite interesting. I quite like writing period stuff, and without being flippant about it, one of the great things about writing period drama is that there are no mobile phones, because characters have to interact with each other, you know, face to face. And that's actually inherently more dramatic than two people talking on a mobile phone, which is, of course, how we all communicate now. So, of course, it's reflected in the drama. But I think it's actually a bit of a problem for script writers, because it means that so much interaction that we have as characters in everyday life is done through these machines. And actually, there's so much less that people can do or have to do independently of that. And so so it's actually, in another sort of way, it's actually harder to tell good stories set now than I think it is to tell stories set in the past that have more inherent dramatic quality. And that maybe I don't know if that makes any sense, but
yeah, I guess there's only so many ways you can shoot a text message conversation and make it more dramatic.
Yeah, and it becomes such a kind of standard thing. It's interesting how when, I don't know if you watched the Dracula that was on over Christmas, I thought that, you know, the episode where it goes to the present day and he's on a mobile phone was infinitely the weakest episode, maybe not the only reason for that. But actually, it just has a sort of slightly, has a diluting effect on drama in a curious sort of way, that so many things can be done so easily because of these marvellous inventions that we all have at our disposal. It actually makes drama a bit more difficult.
Well, Tony, it's been a pleasure to get your stories. Like I said, you know, I can watch Microman over and over again and never get bored of it. And for any of our listeners outside the UK may not have checked it out, we'll of course link it up. Thank you so much for coming on and being our guest this week and giving us those stories, Tony.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for asking.